Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll meet glass artist Don Cheeseman. We'll hear the story of Delmarva's longest living Civil War veteran. And naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about the summer shorebirds of Ocean City and Assateague. Don Cheeseman is a glass artist who makes fused glass sculptures, windows, and jewelry. Don grew up surfing in California, so moving to the beaches of Delmarva in his retirement was like coming home. Before he retired, Don was a baseball coach and high school teacher at Georgetown Preparatory School in Rockville, Maryland. He picked up glass art from his sister in Oregon. Currently, he is most interested in creating projects with fused glass.
I use a technique that's a little bit different than what most people do, although it's becoming pretty popular. I paint with glass. So what I do is I crush glass. I'll heat various types of glass up to around 1300, 1350 degrees, drop it in a bucket of cold water. That completely shatters the glass into everything from powder to, you know, quarter inch chunks of glass. I'll separate it out, and with the powders I'll create certain effects, and with the various other types of pieces they call frit, F-R-I-T, frit, I'll fill in gaps and do various types of things, and then also build up layers as well. So a piece could be a half inch thick, with various layers and levels of glass, various dimensions built into it. So you can get, you know, you can control the color, you can control the texture, you can do a variety of different things that way. My own work is pretty much abstract, although I'll do symbols and things of that nature. I made a window for Georgetown Prep, it's a Jesuit school. I made the Jesuit seal. I did one of the Ignatius Loyola seal and the John Carroll seal. He was a very prominent figure in Maryland history. I do at times do figurative stuff. There's a way that you can embed, for instance, you can embed images from photos or in various types of ways, embed images in glass and work from that.
Don has recently done some work collaborating with a Haitian artist who works in metal.
It's a direction I started moving about a year ago, just one of the things I like to do, and I found that it gives me a chance, in a way, to do, you know, fish scales behind the fish scales, you know, to create the fish, because all I'm getting is a skeleton and the metal, and then the undersea scenery, which is really easy to do in glass, because it's clear light coming through it, and it actually looks like water and that sort of, and various things underneath the sea. I did one of a crane, actually probably a heron, and I did the background scenery at sunset with the marsh. I put the green with the stringers, glass stringers that I could make as well, crushed glass and various types of things going on behind it that you might actually see in a marsh scene. So, you know, that's a lot of fun as well. I just finished, in the background, if you look at my webpage, my Facebook page, you'll see a 24-foot window that I did. I was asked to help create a spiritual space, a space that would get people to sort of move, to consider, you know, ponder the deep questions of life and so on and so forth. And, you know, I built this 24-foot window, 18 2x4 panels that are part of this really beautiful space. That's in D.C., Washington, D.C., a little chapel down in D.C., near Catholic University. I've done the Black Madonna image for a small chapel down in D.C., and it's just simple figures of a mother holding a child. It's not super elaborate, it's very simple. And I like to do if I'm doing figures, I like to do simple figures. The dimensions of glass, when light's coming through, the glass is, you know, just arouses your sense of the spirit and that whole world and emotions. Some of the topics, some of the things I do for myself are based on my own emotional life. I grew up at the ocean, so I love making things that are associated with the ocean and with water. I make waves. I actually make waves. Waves that are, and they're actually curling over and breaking just a little bit. I surfed for a long time, so I make, surf. I was around people that shaped and made surfboards. I apply the same techniques, and I make surfboards. So I learned how to make surfboards by looking at people make surfboards, and I do the same thing. And that's really fun to do. I like doing things like that.
Surfing not only inspires Don's subject matter, it is a practice that has infused his approach to his art.
Every wave is different. So you're improvising and learning every single time you do something. You also have to have tremendous patience because you're sitting out there waiting. Having the patience to to put together a really intricate piece, is part of the whole process. Like every piece I make, and this has been true since the very beginning, every piece I make is just prologue to the next piece. It's teaching me something. And as I'm working with this piece, and as I'm seeing, glass has unintended consequences. There's no glass artist out there in the world that gets exactly what they intended. You're trying to control it as much as you can at times. Sometimes you're not, but at times you want to have a certain outcome, but there's still going to be something there that process teaches you. You're putting it in an oven, you're cooking it, and there's only so much control you can have over that process, over the outcome. So everything I do teaches me something. And as I'm doing it, this is the part that I like the most, I'm already thinking about how that inspired me to make the next thing that I want to make or to go in the next direction I want to go in. Not necessarily repeat the process, but to take that and build on it.
Don Cheeseman is currently living and working in Worcester County, where he hopes to build a studio. Find out about his upcoming shows on his Facebook page, which you can get to from our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. That's also where you'll find a video of this interview and see samples of his work. It's time for a short break now. When we come back, we'll hear the story of Delmarva's longest-living Civil War veteran. Art strolls are definitely a habit worth forming. Every month, enjoy a great night out while supporting local artists and businesses. Galleries and shops stay open late. Opening receptions feature special gallery exhibits. Often there is free entertainment. Many of Delmarva's communities now have monthly art strolls. Visit our website so you can get in the art stroll habit. DelmarvaAlmanac.com/artstrolls. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. Cinepuxent, Maryland is perhaps not much to speak of as towns go. It is merely all that beautiful forest and farmland in Worcester County between West Ocean City and Berlin. It is known for being the birthplace of two military men of notable distinction. One is the great naval hero, Stephen Decatur. But our story today is about the other, an amazing man who lived long enough to be the last surviving veteran of the Civil War on Delmarva. His name was Corporal Isaiah Fassett. Isaiah was born a slave on the Cinepuxent plantation of the Brough family, March 17, 1844. As a young child, his parents were sold south to Georgia, and he never saw them again. He would have been forced to spend all his days working on that plantation, but fate intervened. In 1863, when Isaiah turned 19, the Civil War was well underway. Worcester County residents were divided between Confederate and Union loyalties. White men who had not already gone off to war were either Southern sympathizers, Confederate blockade runners, or, though committed Unionists, they preferred to sit out the war and tend to their own business instead. The Union Army began looking for recruits in the area as casualties depleted their reserves. Colonel William Birney was sent to the Eastern Shore to lead enlistment raids. He enticed slaves to run away aboard a steamship, which was docked at the riverfront in Snow Hill. When the slaves arrived there, they were greeted with a brass band playing in their honor. The boat's official name was Paradise, but blacks referred to it as the Jesus Boat. Many free blacks volunteered. Then, General Order No. 329 was issued. This allowed recruiters to pay plantation owners to free their slaves if those slaves agreed to join the Union Army. Slave owners were also allowed to pay to have a slave take their place, or that of a family member when a draft was issued. On November 11, 1863, Isaiah Fassett's owner, Sarah A. Brough, signed his deed of manumission and release of service. She did not do this because she suddenly realized it was wrong to hold another human being in bondage, or because she was now warm to the Union. She did it for the $300 she was paid for each slave she convinced to join the Union Army. Isaiah and his brothers all agreed to become Union soldiers and joined the 9th United States Colored Troops. Their joyous freedom was quickly replaced with military discipline and the horrors of war. After training at a camp in St. Mary's County, they were off to South Carolina, where they fought in the Wilderness Campaign and at John's Island. Their regiment then moved north into Virginia, fighting in several engagements. At one point, things were so bad that Isaiah did not feel like he could go on. He later told his niece Katie, quote, "I had marched and marched until I really thought I couldn't go a step further. I got to a place where the grass was nice and green under a large tree. I says to myself, this is a good place to give up. Just then I looked up higher in the tree where a buddy had been hanged and was dangling. Well, I braced myself up and began marching again. I realized there was no need to stop after all, and I found energy I didn't know I had." Unquote. It's not clear from the text of the story who did the hanging, but the Confederates had a policy of taking no blacks as prisoner. All were to be considered escaped slaves, a crime punishable by death. His niece's account says that Isaiah liked to tell the story with animated humor. She said that, quote, "he could tell it so as to make his listeners laugh and laugh," unquote. I guess when you've been through something so terrible, making fun of it is one way to keep it from breaking you. They say that humor is what is left when something is too tragic for tears. So Isaiah carried on and served in the war to the best of his ability. This is the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and you're listening to the story of Delmarva's longest-living Civil War veteran. Isaiah's unit took part in the Siege of Petersburg, which was General Ulysses S. Grant's campaign to cut supply lines to the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. This began badly. A mine shaft was secretly dug from behind Union lines to a strategic point under the Confederate encampment. On July 30, 1864, explosives were set off at the end of the tunnel, creating a large crater. In the ensuing confusion, the Union attacked. Major General Ambrose Burnside was ordered at the last minute by Major General George Meade to hold back the U.S. Colored Troop regiments that were specifically trained for this mission, and instead sent in white troops that were not fully informed what to do. The plan was a disaster. There were many casualties and no ground was gained. Grant's forces were stuck in and around Petersburg for 8 more months, engaging in brutal trench warfare. Meanwhile, General Robert E. Lee, realizing he was soon going to be outnumbered, began offering slaves their freedom in exchange for military service with the Confederacy. He, too, was running out of troop replacements, and the Southern cause was slowly unraveling. It was not long before he surrendered at Appomattox. Isaiah and his regiment were there. By the time he was done with his military service, Isaiah was promoted to corporal. The 9th Regiment lost a total of 315 men during the war. 266 of those died of disease. Amazingly, only 46 enlisted men and one officer died from their battle wounds. After the war ended, Isaiah's company was sent to Texas, then shipped to Cuba, and back again to New Orleans. There was great pressure on the soldiers to reenlist for the new cavalry units being formed from their regiment. Isaiah, however, was ready to go home. He completed the hitch he had originally agreed to and was mustered out 3 years and almost 2 weeks after he had signed up. For the first time in his life, he was free to decide his future for himself. He made his way back to Delmarva, and within a year he was wed to Sally Purnell in Berlin. They were blessed with 8 children and 59 years together before she passed away. Isaiah made his living as a carpenter and taught his sons this trade. He kept up a garden until the very end of his life. Even during World War II, he grew his own vegetables in a victory garden. In later years, Isaiah was known affectionately as Uncle Zier. He was a devout Christian, active in his church, with a great concern for his town and for those who had less than he did. He enjoyed singing hymns, teaching Sunday school, and telling the stories of his war experience. He loved to wear his uniform and to march or ride a horse in the annual Memorial Day parade, which he did until near the end of his life. When he was too old and not well enough to take part, Uncle Zier would dress up and stand at attention on his front porch as the parade passed by. He was very proud of his service, not just for the glory of the uniform, but because he loved his community and his country. In 1938, when he was 94, he proudly traveled to Pennsylvania to attend a reunion of his old unit at the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Uncle Zier was the commander of the Grand Army of the Republic Post 51 in Berlin, a precursor to the American Legion that disbanded as Civil War veterans died out. When the Berlin Post closed, he was welcomed into the GAR Post in Delaware, even though he had never lived there. Eventually, he outlived all the other Civil War veterans there as well. He was the last one living between Cape Charles and Philadelphia, and there was only one other in Maryland when he died, June 24, 1946, at the age of 102. If you'd like to learn more about this revered ancestor of the Berlin community, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history, or visit the Calvin B. Taylor Museum, where they have a display dedicated to him. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On August 1, 1859, the Fenwick Island Lighthouse was lit for the first time. And on August 4, 1861, several parties of armed secessionists on the eastern shore of Virginia were dispersed by Union troops. It's time for another short break. When we come back, naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about the summer shorebirds of Ocean City and Assateague. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about summer shorebirds of Ocean City and Assateague.
If you spend any time exploring Assateague Island or paddling on the coastal bays behind Ocean City, Maryland, you will likely recognize the signature sound of our summertime barrier islands. The bird making this raucous noise is a willet, appropriately named for the pilwill willet sound it makes. The call you just heard is from the Sibley Birds app for iPhone. If you look towards the sound, your eyes might catch the distinctive black and white stripes that run the length of each wing when the willet goes airborne. The wing markings revealed during flight are the only bold colors on the otherwise drab, mottled brown and gray summer plumage of the willet. When they're not flying and calling, this long-legged, relatively tall shorebird is usually seen standing on the beach or in the salt marsh. Willets are abundant along the Delmarva coast during the summer, where they feed, nest, and raise young. The willet feeds by walking and wading along the shoreline, probing the sand and mud with its long, straight bill. They find marine worms, fiddler crabs, insects, and small shellfish using the sensitive tips of their bills. Willets can feed day and night by just feeling for food with their beaks. In addition to their mostly seafood diet, they will also eat salt marsh grass seeds and shoots. On Delmarva and throughout the mid-Atlantic, willets often breed in colonies. During the spring breeding season, males work furiously to impress females by flying, fluttering, and calling loudly over their marsh nesting area. Shallow nests made of grass are typically built in the high salt marsh. Both parents incubate 4 to 5 camouflaged eggs, which are grayish olive and speckled with brown spots. Only the male willet sits on the eggs at night. After 3 to 4 weeks, the fuzzy chicks will hatch, and the precocial babies will leave the nest the same day. The parents will teach the baby willets how to forage, but the chicks are not provided with food from mom and dad. Much like their shorebird cousins, the killdeer, the parent willets will perform a broken wing display to get the attention of nearby predators and lure them away from vulnerable eggs and babies. Mother willet will cease parenting after 2 to 3 weeks, but the male will remain with the chicks for a while longer. The willet is just one of more than 200 species of shorebird found around the world. Shorebirds are small to medium-sized birds that prefer to feed and nest along beaches and tidal mudflats, fresh and saltwater wetlands, and open prairies and grasslands. Their bodies feature slender, pointed bills for probing in the sand, mud, and soil, and long, skinny legs for wading in shallow water. Shorebirds found on Delmarva include willets, oyster catchers, sandpipers, plovers, dowitchers, avocets, and stilts. Most of our Delmarva species migrate through the peninsula in the spring on their way to breeding grounds in the far north, and again in the fall when they travel south for the winter. Only a few shorebirds breed on Delmarva. During the summer, you can find willets breeding in the marshes of our Atlantic coastal bays and the Chesapeake and Delaware bays. Other local nesting shorebirds include killdeer, black-necked stilt, spotted sandpiper, the federally threatened piping plover, and the American oyster catcher. Like the willet, the oyster catcher is a large shorebird that can be found feeding and breeding behind Ocean City and Assateague during the summer. Unlike its drab-colored cousin, the oyster catcher is more boldly patterned, with a brown back, white belly, black head, and a large, brightly colored red bill. You may hear the oyster catcher's call when visiting Ocean City and Assateague this summer. This recording is from the Sibley Birds app for iPhone. The oyster catcher is named for its specialized method for feeding on oysters, clams, and mussels. These shorebirds are pros at getting to the tasty meat found inside the hard shells of bivalves. If the oyster catcher finds a clam with its shell partially open, it will quickly insert its scissor-like bill into the opening, cutting the strong muscles that pull the two shells together. With the shells unable to close, the oyster catcher can easily remove the meat. If the shell is already closed, they can use their strong bill to hammer and shatter it. Oyster catchers also feed on marine worms and small crabs. In areas of high density, American oyster catchers may form breeding trios, with one male and two females tending one or two nests. They nest on the ground, usually on a marshy island with a sandy ridge high above the high tide mark. The nest is a simple, shallow scrape in the sand, sometimes lined with shells. 1 to 4 gray eggs with brown specks are usually laid by a pair, but nests tended by two females can yield up to 6 eggs. Males and females incubate the eggs for up to 4 weeks. Like the willet, down-covered chicks hatch and leave the nest shortly after. Unlike the willet, both parents feed the chicks for at least 2 months after hatching. After the summer breeding season, willets leave Delmarva and migrate south. American oyster catchers can be found on the coast year-round. Although they are fairly common today, populations of both willets and oyster catchers were in serious decline by the late 1800s due to market hunting and egg collecting. In his book Birds of America, published between 1827 and 1838, naturalist and painter John James Audubon wrote that the eggs of the willet were delicious, and the young birds grow rapidly, become fat and juicy, and by the time they are able to fly, afford excellent food. The tasty shorebirds were hunted for many years after Audubon's account, often for sale in the marketplace and without regulation to protect their populations. During the colonial period, Delmarva's coastal residents would boat out to islands where shorebirds, gulls, and terns nested to collect eggs for sale or use in their own kitchens. The practice, known as egging, disrupted nesting seasons and contributed to a serious decline in shorebird populations up and down the mid-Atlantic. Some eggs became so scarce that egging was adopted by hobbyists who would seek out the rarest of bird eggs to keep as artifacts in their private collections. The name of Great Egging Island, located behind Assateague Island, is a throwback to this colonial tradition. By the early 1900s, willets and American oyster catchers had almost vanished in the northeastern U.S. due to market hunting and egg collecting. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918 banned commercial trade in birds and eggs, and populations have increased over the past 100 years. Both species have adapted to life around humans, but coastal development, bad behavior by recreational boaters who disrespect posted closure signs on nesting islands, and threats from climate change make these shorebirds vulnerable today. One of the most important nesting areas on Delmarva for willets, oyster catchers, and other species of coastal birds are the 25 acres of islands and mudflats that make up the Sinipuxent Wildlife Management Area. Located behind Ocean City and Assateague, this state-managed wildlife refuge includes Skimmer Island, Heron Island, and the newly created Tern Island. Most of the islands are closed in the summer months to allow breeding birds to nest safely. Please observe the posted closure signs that designate these islands as off-limits. If you want to experience Delmarva's fall bird migration by kayak, canoe, and stand-up paddleboard, join the expert guides leading field trips around Laurel, Delaware, and Snow Hill, Maryland during the Delmarva Paddling Weekend, which will be held September 30th through October 2nd. For more information, please visit delmarvapaddling.com. Keep your ears and eyes open for willets and oyster catchers when you're visiting the Delmarva coast this summer. Until next time, I hope this story inspires you to explore and learn more about Delmarva's many natural wonders.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.